Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to Owning It, the bullshit-free anxiety podcast with me, your host and author, Caroline Foran. So I hope you enjoyed the first episode. It was a bit of a brain dump on my part, but that's the hard bit done, and that's the more negative bit out of the way. And now, you'll be glad to hear, we can get a lot more proactive, a lot more positive, and really start to lift the fog of anxiety bit by bit. Now, in Owning It, the book, or Own It, if you're listening in America, I do have one auntie there, so, you know, she might be tuning in. I put forward quite a large but simple strategy for managing or owning anxiety that I call the assess and address technique. It's actually really funny because when I was getting the edits ready for the book to come out in America, which is happening in spring, my editor there was like, I'm not sure about the word assess because when I read it, I just see asses. For anyone who's unsure, this is not about your bottoms. It's about assessing anxiety. So it's the assess and address technique. And it's what got me out of the hellhole I was in. And it's what I return to again and again anytime I feel a little bit of anxiety rising. So the first part is, again, not asses, but to assess what's going on. Looking at not just what anxiety is and what's going on in our bodies and our minds, but getting clarity on where you are right now and why you personally might be experiencing anxiety. Because something that I experienced was feeling like it just came at me like a freight train. But there's usually a reason for it. So assess is where we are for the first few episodes of this podcast. And while you might be listening, thinking like, oh, for fuck's sake, would she ever just tell me what to do? This is part of it. So this assessment part is so unbelievably important. I cannot overstate that. It's a tool in itself. It's educational. And as we know, knowledge is power. And there is just no use throwing the kitchen sink at your anxiety. I want to save you the anguish of doing that, trying this and that, without first beginning by understanding it. I just wish I had started there myself. So hopefully you can learn from my mistakes. So to help me begin the work of assessing anxiety, this week I'm joined by Dr. Claire Kambametu. She's a former Rose of Tralee, actually. Little bit of trivia for you there. You may recognise her from that. I think it was 2010 she was crowned Rose of Tralee. She's a total ride. But she's a new friend of mine. And we've been appearing together at the BIO events all around Ireland with Dearan and Avian Garrahy. I'm sure you'll know them. And I just really like her vibe. She just has a good energy. But more relevant to the podcast, obviously, she's a clinical psychologist, and not in an intimidating way. She's like a regular person. Obviously, every psychologist is still a regular person, but she just gets it and she just talks so much sense. And that's what we need. We need clarity. We need sense. We don't need no bullshit. And I'm honoured to have her shed some light on the assess part of owning it, or as I call it in the book, the what the fuck is going on with me part. Now, not being anywhere near as crass as me, she's a real lady, Claire calls it psychoeducation. So for this episode, prepare to be psychoeducated, but not in an overwhelming way. She also has an incredibly soothing voice. I could listen to her all day. So this episode should at the very least have an anxiolytic effect just by listening to it. And if you're unsure what that means, anxiolytic is just a fancy word for something that reduces anxiety. So I'm always, always keen on anything anxiolytic. It's probably my favourite word. So I sat down with Claire to look back at my own experience of anxiety, but through her more professional, clear psychology lens. This episode is all about unpacking exactly what anxiety is, why it happens to us, how normal it is to experience. And that's just so important that you realize how normal it is and how you're not actually gone mad. We talk about the fear of the fear. We talk about CBT, which is something that I'm such a fan of, cognitive behavioral therapy. And Claire explains it so well. So if it's something that you've been hearing about, but you're not sure really what it is or find it a bit confusing and you're wondering whether it's something that would help you, you'll enjoy that part. But ultimately, Claire and I discuss the absolute non-negotiable place to start on your road to owning it, which, annoyingly for you, is all about acceptance.
My name is Dr. Claire Campometu, and I'm a clinical psychologist. And what that means is that I work with people who experience challenges in relation to their mental health. So over the last number of years, I've worked with young people, so kids really, under the age of 18, and then adults as well, from 18 upwards. I suppose on a day-to-day basis, the kind of things that I would do with people is hear their story and understand how they've reached the point that they've reached, and then try and figure out how for them as an individual they might go forward in terms of helping themselves to feel a little bit happier. Or even just to be in a place of acceptance with what's going on for them.
You've heard my story, and we've been on the BO panel together a few times. Mm-hmm. Hearing my experience of anxiety, which I thought was, I was on my own for it, as a professional, is it so normal to you to hear what I'm saying?
In lots of ways it is. I mean, everybody has their own unique story and their own unique pathway to winding up feeling anxious. But anxiety is a really normal emotion for all of us. I don't know if you've seen that movie Inside Out. But
It gave me anxiety. I was like, I can't deal with this. I think I was in a bad wave at the time when it came out. Mm. And I was like, I need to get out of my head.
Yes, yeah. And it's not. It's all about being inside your head. Yeah. But one of the things that I really like about it is that it talks about those basic emotions. And fear is one of the things that we're born with. We feel it from the second we're born. And it's very helpful because when we feel fear or we feel anxious, it's our body and our mind's way of saying, wait a second, there's something here that is a bit of a threat. So people might have that experience of feeling threatened for a number of different reasons. And it's really normal to feel that growing up and to feel frightened, to feel anxious, whether it's about tests or about friends or about something that's going on at home. And then I suppose what can happen for people is that when they go through that experience, especially as a younger person, and they're maybe trying to figure out what their feelings are, if the people around them, so teachers and parents and friends, don't know very much about what they're feeling, they're left with this feeling that what they feel is really, really bad. And that creates an extra layer then, because not only are they maybe worried about something in particular or just feeling anxious, but then they're also feeling anxious about being anxious.
Like for me, I suppose I've struggled to understand why anxiety was an issue for me as a kid when, you know, looking back, I came from like a relatively normal family and I'd, you know, good friends and my brother was great to me and I did well in school and I couldn't really find any reason. Is it just a natural sort of disposition towards it or... Yeah.
Well, we're all born with a different temperament. So temperament is something that we inherit. It's biological and genetically inherited trait. So it might be that one of our parents or maybe one of our parents' parents has had a more anxious temperament. So it's something that as a kid, we might just feel a little bit more than other people. And then I suppose it also depends on how people around us respond to that anxiety and that fear. And all parents, I mean, every parent wants to be the best parent. Of course they do. And the majority of parents are good enough parents, which is exactly what we need kids to have. But every parent will find something that they're not able to do because they're not superheroes at the end of the day. And I suppose the important thing for kids is with those basic emotions that they feel is to have this thing called containment, where they learn through their parents' response to their feeling that this emotion that they have is really normal and it's okay and it's not going to kill them. So I suppose that's a thing that can sometimes happen for people. If they're more biologically anxious and then they're experiencing a lot of anxiety, one of the things I know that can make it worse than in the teenage years is not having that containment, not having learned that sense either through parents or through teachers or somebody older than them, that this is just a feeling and it'll be okay.
And not even knowing that it's anxiety in the first place. Because I certainly had no clue. And like, I just hope that for future generations, I know we've talked about how social media and things make it more challenging, but also the fact that they'll have the awareness of, you know, me coming home as a kid being like, I don't feel well, I have a pain in my tummy, will register, I think, to a more contemporary parent.
I hope that as well, because and one of the things that I know that you experienced was that pain in your tummy from a very early age. And when I worked in children's services, that was probably the most common presentation of anxiety. The majority of parents, whether they knew about anxiety or not, would come in and say, you know, my child doesn't want to go to school anymore. They're saying they're sick every day. Or else they might say, actually, my GP sent me in here. I don't know what's wrong with them, but they're saying they're sick. Because anxiety is a real biological impact on our whole bodies. But when you think about the fight or flight response, which is what anxiety is where we feel there's a threat. And then we know that we either need to fight off that threat or run away from it. Our body doesn't need blood in our digestive system and in our stomach. It needs blood in our fingers and our toes.
To run away.
To run away or to fight. If you're going to punch a saber-toothed tiger in the head, then you're going to need a lot of strength in your fists. Or if you're going to run away, you need it in your legs.
Yeah.
You do not need it.
Don't need to be digesting food.
You don't need to be digesting food. That's something that we do when we're relaxed and when we're maybe sleeping or going for a gentle walk or something like that. Or just sitting around. So the blood drains out of our tummies. And that's where an awful lot of people with anxiety get real, can sometimes be nausea, it can be digestive discomfort, it can be wind or bloating, just a feeling like things aren't right because their body is constantly channeling and pumping that blood out to their extremities rather than keeping it in their tummies.
And then you start to stress about the fact that that's happening. So I wasn't able to connect the dots between my digestive issues and anxiety, but what it did was make me more anxious because now I was trying to solve this problem that I couldn't tell the wood from the trees. So something that I find comes up again and again when I talk to people about anxiety is that the lack of awareness of how it can sort of creep up on you from experiencing stress. And I think so many of us are experiencing a level of stress that we don't even realize in this day and age. And you know, you think it's come out of the blue, or someone will say to you, what's happened, or why are you having a panic attack? And there's not that awareness of, you know, you can be, from my experience, I was probably at like a 6 or a 7 on a scale of 1 to 10, and you know, you wouldn't really have any symptoms maybe then, and then it doesn't take very much to push it up a little bit more, and then suddenly I'm feeling very anxious, and I'm having these worried thoughts and these symptoms, and thinking, nothing, this is just, I'm crazy, it's come out of nowhere.
And if you're the type of person as well who experiences anxiety, again, it's a really biological difficulty. So as soon as we have an anxious thought, our body releases, or our brain releases, a jolt of adrenaline. And adrenaline makes us more likely, so it narrows our attention, so we focus in maybe on things that are more scary for us. So if you're at, say, like maybe 2 or 3 on that anxiety spectrum of 0 to 10, and then you have one anxious thought and it releases that adrenaline, you become more focused then on maybe something else that isn't good. So then it might creep up to maybe a 4, and maybe again you're not even knowing that it's creeping up to a 4, but the more anxious you feel, the more adrenaline your body's producing, and the more focused you become on the more drastic things. And then maybe it's going up and up and up to a 4 or 5 or 6, which is maybe where somebody might feel the real biological symptoms. Yeah. And it's different for everybody. And then all of a sudden they notice that they're anxious. And then there's a model of therapy, and we might talk about that in a while, but cognitive behavioural therapy. And they talk about the metacognitive model of anxiety, which is where we go from being worried about something outside of us to then worrying about the worry itself.
Oh my God, that is me all over. I was never afraid of, you know, in my body and my mind, I felt as if there was a murderer outside my door all the time, or as if I was about to go up and give a presentation, which is really anxiety inducing to me. And someone would say, well, there isn't a murderer outside. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make it any better. What I'm anxious about is the fact that I'm anxious, and the fact that I'm feeling the symptoms, that it's the fear of the fear got me more than anything. There was never anything tangible, because you can rationalize something tangible. So that's just huge, isn't it?
It's huge. And I think really understanding anxiety as both a physical thing, but also as as an emotional thing is really important, because like you're saying, you know, somebody can say, well, rationalize that, you know, this bad thing is very unlikely to happen. And that's helpful overall in reducing our kind of longer term levels of anxiety. But actually, when your body is pumped full of hormones and chemicals that have been released from anxiety, telling yourself that those bad things aren't going to happen are not going to get rid of the shortness of breath or the sensation that you're going out of control.
Yeah. Or telling yourself to be more positive.
Telling yourself to be more positive.
That kind of shit wrecks my head.
Yeah, and it's grand in the long run to do all of those in tandem. But actually, the only thing you can do with anxiety in that moment when it's so high is to accept it. And then...
Own it.
Own it is to actually own it and go, let it happen. I'm really anxious. You know, I'm really anxious right now. And then be able to bring the conversation in our heads around to, not what am I going to do to get rid of this, but how can I help myself maybe in this, just in this moment, forgetting about the next day or the next whatever.
Exactly. It is. And that's such a symptom of anxiety, is to not be able to contain yourself in the moment and to think, what am I going to be like this time next year? And, you know, it's just so hard to focus on where you are right now.
Yeah, and you've just used that word contain again.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's what we're trying to do, and what we need to do as a society is to help young people develop the ability to contain their own feelings, so that when they become adults, they're also able to do that. And if you think about containment as a concept, it's like providing a container for a kid to pour their feelings in, but it's a solid container, so it stops it sloshing out all over the place and washing all over their lives.
Yeah.
And I know it's a real kind of psychological concept, but it's so important.
No, it's so visceral. Like, it's, you know, you need to let it out. It's still valid. You're worried. I find, not without going too much off tangent, I find that there's so much talk these days about thinking positive and this complete disregard for our worries, or just telling the voice in your head to shut up. And I find that if I try and deny my worries and my concerns, they get bigger, because they're valid to me. Absolutely. Or like, if it's a kid, I feel like, you know, if I'm a 7-year-old and I'm scared of going up to bed and maybe there's a monster or something, and to an adult you're like, oh, don't be silly, well, that kid does feel fear, and it is a big deal to them. So I feel like if you shove positivity down your throat and deny all negativity, it'll come back to kind of bite you in the arse.
Absolutely, it totally does. Because when we invalidate either ourselves or other people, it doesn't help the emotion. Like, you think about any emotion that you feel. If somebody's angry and somebody goes, oh, don't be ridiculous, like, how the hell do you feel? Grand, so I'll just, because I didn't know that myself, I'll just relax now because you've told me to. Actually, validating our emotions is one of the most helpful things we can do to ourselves, or for ourselves. So, I mean, I do agree that there's some parts of how we think and how we feel that we need to challenge from time to time. So you change maybe what you can, but when you know that you can't change something and that actually it's destructive for you to try and do it, then the only other option is acceptance. And also, we're being sold this message nowadays as well that we should all be well and we should all be happy and we should all be totally grand because life is great. And if you're not feeling that, then you need to do something about it. Life is freaking hard, and it's full of suffering and pain and difficulty, as well as more enjoyable experiences and happiness. And actually, we need to be more realistic in our perspective.
Yeah, and we can't kind of cut ourselves off from negative experiences. You know, it's actually only then that you get perspective as well, I find. I want to talk to you about the parts of the brain that are involved in anxiety. So for me, it was like a revelation when I learned that, you know, in terms of the science of what's happening, that if I'm stressed, and you'll probably explain it better than me, basically that the higher
not. I don't know very much.
What was happening was that the higher thinking part of my brain, the prefrontal cortex, which is where we have logic and reason, was being worn down over time. So while I would have an anxious reaction to something and I'd think, oh God, I'm such a disaster, this is all my fault, in a way it wasn't my fault, because the stress had eroded the strength of my prefrontal cortex to such an extent that now the amygdala, which is the more primitive part of my brain, was firing off, and it was kind of in the driving seat. And I think even if you can't do anything about it, knowing that that's happened makes you feel a little bit more like, okay, I can sort of stand back and see that that's happened, and it makes sense. So talk to me about those different players in the brain.
So the amygdala is a really, really important part of our brain when it comes to anxiety, but actually all emotions. And it's at the top of our spine, kind of at the base of our brain. And it was one of the first parts of our brain to develop when we evolved to become humans. So if you think about how our spine grew, and when we were originally tiny little fishes swimming around in the sea, our spine was one of the first parts of our brain to kind of develop, or the top of our spine. So the amygdala is where it's a very primal kind of center of ourselves, and it's where a lot of our feelings are based. And it regulates emotion, or it helps to regulate it. But actually, the other thing that regulates emotion is our prefrontal cortex, as you said. So that's at the top of your head, kind of behind your forehead.
I'm so glad I got that right.
So that's the bit where, as you were saying, it's responsible for our executive functioning. Yes. So they are the higher order thinking skills: planning, decision making, rationalizing, turning things from thought into reality, all of those kinds of things. And we need it on a day-to-day basis to do everything, really, to live our lives in as successful way as we can. But what happens when we're feeling very anxious is it's almost like the amygdala takes over. Nothing can get through. If you imagine, this isn't how the science works, but mm-hmm. if you can imagine it, a message being sent from your spine, and it's trying to get through to your brain, but it gets caught at this like big trapdoor at the top of your spine and the base of your brain.
Okay.
So it can't, it's coming through, it's almost like it's seeping in under the door, but our brain isn't able to make sense of it in the same way as if that door was just open. And in the same way then, when our prefrontal cortex is receiving all these messages that something isn't quite right, it's not able to send a clear and coherent message back.
Yeah.
Because again, that door is closed. So in order for, and I think the thing is, it's awareness, really. I mean, with anything when it comes to our mental health, awareness is a big part of it. And actually, there's another book called The Chimp Paradox.
Oh, I loved it. I quoted that so much in The Confidence Kit, actually. Yeah. It's just, and that's again where I got the whole idea of not denying your worries, your negatives, kind of letting them run out like a chimp until they exhaust themselves.
Exactly. So we all have to recognize and be aware that this is the kind of chimp part of our brain, if you like. And that the only way, we can't change that. The only thing we can do is recognize when it's in action, and then help ourselves to like gradually maybe open the door little by little, little by little, so that our thoughts and our feelings and everything else, all of those messages are able to be transmitted to the part of our brain that needs to hear it so that they can decide what to do about it more effectively.
What do you think most people get wrong about anxiety? You know, we spoke about all those things online, things that inspired me to write Owning It, which were preying on our vulnerability of, you know, do this one thing and you won't feel anxiety tomorrow. What do you think we're getting wrong?
I think one of the first things is that we think that there should be a cause for our anxiety. Sometimes there's a cause, sometimes there's not. Sometimes the anxiety itself is the cause of the anxiety getting bigger and bigger and more out of control. So the first thing is actually trying to understand where your anxiety is coming from. I think that's important, and it's a valuable piece of work to do once the anxiety is a little bit more under control. So I think, yeah, the first thing is actually validating our own emotions. I think that's a really, really important part of responding to our own suffering, whether that's anxiety or not.
And if I had have come to you at the time and told you the story of me sort of leaving the job and feeling like I couldn't really cope, what would you have said to me? Would that have made sense to you?
That would have made total sense. I mean, whenever something happens in our lives that's a little bit stressful, and stress we tend to associate with negative things. We tend to associate them with bad stuff that happens. But there can be good stresses as well. So stress might be moving house or starting a new job if it was one that you really enjoyed, as well as one that you didn't enjoy so much. It can just be about change. So if anybody came to me and said, well, actually, I'm managing this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing, I'd be thinking, well, you know what, I see people who are really under stress just because of one of those things.
Okay.
It makes total sense why you would be feeling anxious, even if you'd never felt anxious before that point.
So one of the main things that we're doing wrong is not validating or letting ourselves validate our anxiety.
Yeah, not exactly, not validating, not telling ourselves that, okay, this is a feeling that we have, and that feeling is valid and it's there for a reason, whether we understand the reason or not, and that what we need to do is help ourselves. Because so often we say, whether we're feeling low or we're feeling anxious or feeling angry or feeling sad, we might say, you know, oh, for God's sake, just get on with it, or that's a stupid way to feel, I can't believe you'd feel that way. And then we go into critical mode.
Mm.
And if we're going into that mode with any of those feelings, it doesn't make it better.
No.
It just makes it worse, a lot worse. So the first thing that we can do to help ourselves is go, okay, this is happening.
Yes.
This is happening to me, and it's okay that it's happening. This is just a normal part of the human experience, is to go through these really difficult times and to feel these difficult things.
Yeah, that's just, it was, I feel like everything changed for me when I was willing to own that vulnerability and sit there in the midst of panic and just let it happen.
Mm.
And I feel like, I don't know if you would agree, but the only way to open that back door where the amygdala is blocking things is to let it do its thing for a while and then maybe put yourself into a situation that's going to be soothing and relaxing so that the chimp or whatever it is in the amygdala calms down a little bit. And then I kind of learned this just from experience that I'd have these sort of waves of anxiety. It wasn't necessarily one isolated panic attack. It might be a week of anxiety where I'd have a surge of adrenaline and cortisol or whatever, and then the panic thing would be over, but I'd still be feeling really fragile and really vulnerable, and because my thoughts were still heavily tinged with fear and the amygdala was still ruling the roost, and I started to recognize that it would take a couple of days before that would rebalance again. And then I started to realize, okay, when it's happening, it's off.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
But I know that it usually rectifies and comes back. So I started to be like, look forward to that and know and trust that that would happen. But I think the biggest mistake I made, and not to be hard on myself, but I think I probably would have gotten to a place of owning it a lot sooner had I not been trying so desperate not to feel it. Trying so desperately not to avoid stress or isolate myself from things that would give me anxiety. Because if I had have actually done that, I would have avoided life itself, you know. So I think one of the biggest things that I always tell people is, like you say, just to here I am right now.
And to normalize that experience. Like, stress is normal. Anxiety on lots of different levels is normal. And it's human. And it is what makes us human, is being able to feel those things. And it might be pleasant, but it's really normal. And it's okay to feel that way. Not okay when you're in the middle of a panic attack and you're feeling like, oh my God, my life is over. I don't want to be this way. I don't want to live like this. But actually, I think it's really important to remind ourselves that these are feelings. They're not going to kill us. They're a normal part of our world. And even if that's all we just say to ourselves in that moment, it's just accepting it in the moment that that experience is your experience and that it's not always going to be that way. And I think, I mean, one of the helpful things over time when it comes to managing anxiety is that cognitive behavioral therapy piece. Yeah. But so often, like you're saying, you know, it's wrapped up in you being able to get in contact with your prefrontal cortex and with your ability to plan and make decisions and to think about things and rationalize and all that. And if that chimp part of our brain is jumping up and down, we can't do that. So even if you can just ask yourself one question when you're in that really anxious moment, and that's, what would be helpful? Like, not trying to change anything, not trying to change the experience. What would be helpful in this moment? If I can't think of anything and I want to just tell myself to just sit down on the floor, do that. If I think I'll have a hot shower, that might be helpful, do that. But just that one question, what's helpful in this moment? And it might change moment to moment to moment to moment. But just, even if it's just giving yourself like a quick hug.
Yeah.
If you're not able to access that part of your brain that rationalizes more so, just even if you can keep that one thing in mind. Or as you say, let the chimp exercise, let it run around, go in, lie down on the floor, work it out of your system, go for a run.
Or write it down.
Let it out. Talk to somebody if there's a trusted person that you can talk to.
Something that I found really helpful in terms of owning my own anxiety was understanding the negativity bias. And I know we already spoke about, I don't see it as totally useful to completely deny negativity, but can you just give me your expert perspective on what that is, and again, how normal that is? Because I think people feel under pressure to be positive and they feel like there's something wrong, because obviously with anxiety it's like you have a magnifying glass on everything negative.
Mm. Can you tell me a bit what you mean by the negativity bias? Because I have two ideas in my mind and I'm not sure.
So for me it's all about how in all through history we've been primed to go negative, and to go back to the hunter-gatherer times, that you had to place more importance on negative things happening because that could mean you would get killed by a lion or whatever. And so from what I've read, we place an awful lot less significance on positive things, and it takes quite a few positive experiences to sort of balance out a negative. And just understanding that that's how the brain works, and that thinking negatively is actually a survival kind of thing as well, made me feel also like I could let myself off the hook a little bit more. So all these little things that were making me feel like I was normal, and again, just normalizing the anxiety. So that's for me what the negativity bias.
No, that makes sense. And there's a little bit of not conflict in schools of thought, but one of the pieces around the negativity bias is that there is a part of our brain that encodes more positive memories, and that can be something that if it's if we're able to activate that part of our brain, is actually something that makes us more resilient. So if we practice actually remembering and drawing positive memories to mind over time, it can be a way of then accessing those memories more easily when we notice we're being more negative. But you're totally right in that our brain is primed to look for threat, because you think about it back, you know, when we were more primitive, there was one aim to our existence, and that was survival. And then through reproduction, the survival of our genetic, I don't know, offspring, I suppose.
Yes.
So it was all about survival. So if that was the biggest thing that we were trying to achieve, of course, we're going to be more primed to look for things that are going to stop that from happening. So our brain is constantly scanning the environment, and it's constantly aware of threats, or what we feel might be threats to our survival. Okay. And as we've evolved, that's become different. It's not any longer about physical survival. It's sometimes about emotional survival, like surviving in the sense of, okay, I feel like a good enough person. And for a lot of people, they might be scanning their social environments, their emotional environments, and their brain is picking up on this information and paying attention to the things that are emotionally threatening. So things that maybe make them feel like a crappy person, or like they're not good enough, or like they're not strong enough or capable enough, or whatever it is. So there's a really, I think it's really important what you're saying there, that our brain is still really primal. Like, we think of ourselves as these very evolved creatures, but actually our brain is a very, very primal part of us. And while it's capable of doing amazing things, it's also capable of kind of getting stuck in responding to, in the way that we would have responded a long, long time ago.
But we've just replaced a hyena or a bunch of lions with, you know, a boardroom scenario,
exactly.
That kind of thing.
Yeah, criticism from our boss, or a friend not liking us very much, or not being popular enough, or not being a good enough parent, or not being a good enough daughter, whatever it is, there's always something there.
What do you think, from my story, were the emotional threats that I was obviously picking up on without being, like, consciously aware of at the time when I moved job? Do you think it was like not feeling like I could handle the work? What would you see there?
Well, I think when we go through change, whether it's positive or negative, it takes away our security and our sense of self. So for example, I might feel like, okay, well, I'm a good enough person, okay, but then I change something around, so maybe I'm in a new environment, so I'm working with people that I don't know, or I'm doing a job that I haven't done before. So that sense of myself, that belief that I'm a good enough person, is threatened a little bit by just even going into a different situation. Now, maybe all of the things in that environment, I'll get feedback from my boss that I'm doing a great job. I'll get, you know, feedback from the new people that I've met that they like working with me. But I suppose our brain is constantly scanning for things that might threaten us. So if that's the thing that's going to be threatened, so it might have been just the lack of security you felt in that space. Just a lot of change in one go. And I don't know. I mean, you'll probably be able to trace back. Can you remember what it was that you were kind of feeling or thinking about at the time?
I remember it was just such a physical reaction. Mm-hmm. And straight away, it's like my body knows before I... I always say there's two selves. You know, there's a part of me that hasn't quite caught up with it yet. And I felt... I think initially I felt... like I'd made a mistake, and I was berating myself for having made a mistake or having made the wrong move in my career. And then it was just this massive feeling of shame that I wasn't able to handle it like I thought everyone else would be able to handle it.
So those two things, even just in that bit, and I know there was probably an awful lot more that came from that. So one part of your kind of thinking about yourself and your career and being maybe successful or being good enough in terms of where you were going, that was being really challenged. That idea, like, I'm in the wrong place for me, or I've made a mistake. And then the other bit there that you mentioned about not being resilient enough. I should be able to cope with this. I should be able.
Yeah. That's the biggest mental block, I think, for me, that only really probably in the last year I've started to come around to, is my ideas of strength and my ideas of weakness. And I used to, when my anxiety was so bad and I was hanging out of my mom's arm because I was like a child again, I just kept saying to her, like, it's like, this sounds so dramatic, but like I was born with like a broken wing or something. There's just always something a little bit amiss. And I always said that was weakness. And I don't know why, but I guess lately I'm starting to see my willingness to embrace that as actually my strength.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's been like just such a life changer, you know, and stop seeing myself as, again, it comes back to the social comparison thing of like, this person could handle it, or looking at my friends who, you know, their jobs were so intense and I was thinking I couldn't cope with that, or I was watching TV and looking at characters in fictional worlds thinking I couldn't cope with that. And I was projecting everything onto everyone else and thinking I'm shit, they're great, they're capable, I'm not. And maybe it was just that my body was aware enough, or maybe there was just such a strong intuition there that my body could say to me, this isn't right for you, whereas maybe someone else wouldn't present with any symptoms of anxiety and then later on fall down in a heap and have an issue. So I had to sort of learn to respect my DNA again, and, you know, yeah, and really stop being so hard on myself about the weakness thing. You know, so it's such a hard thing to...
It really is, and it's something, you know, we get a lot of, well, we learn a lot, I suppose, when we're growing up about what we think vulnerability is, or what we think weakness is, and what it's like to be strong or good or bad, whatever it is, how we define things. There's a woman called Brené Brown.
Oh, I love her.
Love her, yeah.
And she, I actually only watched her TED Talk again last night. Yeah, yeah, that is just, once you get that in your head,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and actually that's the meaning of vulnerability in a way, is being able to be honest about what we're feeling with ourselves and with other people, if that's appropriate and safe for us. But certainly with ourselves, being open to ourselves and our own experience. And there's so much in what you're saying there about how you judged yourself when you became anxious, and when you felt anxious and judged yourself as being not capable or not as capable.
And that drove more anxiety.
That drove more anxiety, exactly. So if you think about going back to kind of making sense of those experiences you had, being in a situation that for anybody would be challenging because of all the change that was in it, and then your mind kind of reacting in that way where you judged yourself and invalidated what you were experiencing, that generated even more anxiety, and it just grew and grew and grew and grew. So it might start off with a couple of different things, and then it's about learning how to respond to ourselves and learning that it's not our fault that we feel this way, and that it's okay to be open about that. I think that's a really, really important journey. But it's hard. Like, it's really feckin' hard.
It is really hard, yeah. Talk to me about the three states of being, is it, that you say, that we exist in these one of three mindsets that you talked about, threat and...
Oh, yes. Oh, I love this. Okay, yeah. So this is from a model of therapy called self-compassion therapy. And they talk about the three circles. So this is just something that I use, I suppose, as a self-care tip, but it's also something that people might teach a client if they're coming to them to learn a bit more about being self-compassionate. There's a woman called Kristen Neff who is the mother of self-compassion. She does a huge amount of research and she's lots of stuff that are available. But we exist in three different drives, according to self-compassion theory. So one is the threat drive, one is the motivation drive, and one is the soothing drive. So if you think about three kind of different circles, my threat circle is a red circle. When I envision my threat circle, it's red. When I envision my motivation circle, or my motivated drive, it's kind of a blue or a green colour. And then my soothing circle is sometimes green, sometimes yellow, sometimes just a nice colour that I'm drawn to. So I've actually printed these out, and I have three circles then pinned up on my office wall. And the threat circle, when the threat drive is activated, we feel things like fear, anger, anxiety, sadness, kind of lots of negative emotions. And it happens when we're under stress and when we're feeling threatened. So when we're anxious, I suppose, but also when we're feeling other negative things. And the idea of this is that we can then help ourselves identify when we are in the threat drive so that we can get ourselves out of that and into either the motivated drive or into the self-soothing or soothing drive. When I'm in my threat drive, I know how my body feels. I know that I feel tense. I know that I might get headaches from tension. I know that I might not be able to concentrate. And I know that I'll be feeling all these emotional things as well. And when I can flag that and go, wait, I'm in my threat drive here, it then kind of drives me to take action and go, okay, I just need to get out of this. I need to get out of the threat drive. Now, the thing is that you can get out of it for a second, you can get out of it for 30 seconds or an hour or for a whole week, whatever. One of the things I did at the start was put an awful lot of pressure on myself to get out of the threat drive and stay out of it.
Yes, and that is then an issue for me as well. It's like trying to avoid the anxiety.
Exactly, and it's such a normal, like the threat drive might not be the place I want to stay for very long, but it's a really normal part of just being in a really busy, sometimes stressful world and life. It's about recognizing it and then going, what can I do now in this very moment to help myself feel more motivated? Or usually if I'm in the threat drive, it's to help myself feel just a little bit more soothed.
Okay, so that could be something practical like...
So I, it's really very different for lots and lots of people. Okay. I love essential oils, so I have like a little bag of them, and I have some on my desk at work, I have some in my bedroom, I have them in all the important places that I am. And even just like smelling something that I find really grounding.
Okay.
Or changing the channel in my head, if my chimp isn't jumping up and down and I'm able to access that prefrontal cortex, changing the channel and remembering a happier time. Or even just for 30 seconds, just putting my hands on my heart, telling myself I'm going to be okay.
Okay.
Just doing that and saying it over and over again. Sometimes even just getting up and having a herbal tea.
Watching some TLC or Say Yes to the Dress, which is my soothing zone.
Exactly that. Doing whatever it is. But actually, it's really helpful. The thing I love about the cards is how visual they are.
Yeah. And so people should make up these cards and print them off.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think they're a great tool because sometimes when we're in that threat zone, it can be really hard to think of the things that we need to do. And there can also be that little voice in your head that's going, oh, well, even if I do this, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
That's a voice that kind of you have to kind of wave hello to and go, oh, there you are. You're trying to keep me in this threat circle. I see what you're trying to do here. Well, okay, well, maybe you're going to achieve that. Maybe you'll keep me there in like 10 seconds time or 10 minutes time. But for this 1 second, yeah. I'm getting away from
you. Okay, so it can be as little as a 5 second something that soothes you, whatever it is for you. I think it's really important for people to realize that. I know that I felt I was reading a lot of articles on the likes of Mind Body Green, and it was people getting up and having their matcha lattes and chanting at 7 a.m. And great if that works for you, but it didn't work for me, and I felt under pressure then that I wasn't doing good enough at trying to manage my anxiety.
Yeah.
So mindfulness to me is whatever you can do that really puts you into like a nice sort of state of being. So if that's watching some trashy TV, so be it.
Exactly. If it's watching trashy TV, if it's doing something for 10 seconds or half an
hour. It doesn't have to be yoga.
Time-wise, it doesn't have to be yoga. It doesn't have to be a run. It doesn't have to be drinking a really healthy smoothie. It doesn't have to be any of those things. And it does not have to be for a long amount of time. Any time where you are being mindful is better than not being mindful at all. And I say mindful as in just helping yourself maybe feel a little bit better is what I mean. So even if that's just 10 seconds or 10 minutes or 10 hours of TLC, whatever it is, and for however long, it's better than not doing it.
Okay. For people who, I mention CBT all the time and I probably don't give it enough of an explanation, but for someone who's listening to this and who's struggling with anxiety and thinks this sounds like something I should be considering, can you just explain what it is and how it differs from other types of therapy and why it's particularly beneficial for anxiety?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy is a really popular form of therapy, and it's popular because it's one of the most evidenced ways of managing a load of different mental health problems. And when I say evidence-based therapy, I mean therapy that has undergone really rigorous research. So CBT for anxiety has been tested on literally at this point probably hundreds of thousands of people, and we know that it is as effective as an antidepressant medication in terms of treating moderate anxiety, and we know that it is the most scientifically proven effective way of treating anxiety overall. Now, I'm not saying that other approaches don't work. I have used other approaches as well as CBT.
You can bring in different aspects when, like with your therapist, it doesn't have to be pure CBT, right? You can bring in elements of it.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I would practice using lots of different modes of therapy and I would bring those in. So CBT is really a skills-based approach. It's about learning how to link how we think to how we feel. And when I say feel, I mean emotionally, but also in our bodies, and then how those things link into our behavior. And if we can learn to untangle what CBT calls those vicious cycles of getting caught in thinking, feeling and behavior loops that aren't really helpful for us, we then have the opportunity to intervene at the thought level, at the feeling level and at the behavior level to stop the vicious cycle from happening over and over again. So it's really about learning skills that help us to do that. So the first thing that you might learn would be to get in touch with your thinking. And that's easier said than done. You know, it can be a hard and a tricky thing to do, but it's also a very practical thing, and there's skills that you can use to help you do that. And then you can help to learn skills that will help your body to feel a little bit better and help your emotions to feel a little bit better, and then to change your behavior as well, so it's not feeding that loop constantly. So that's really the nuts and bolts of CBT. It is a skills-based package, and that's why it's helpful sometimes when it's done in tandem with other more emotionally focused therapies.
Is there a particular CBT exercise that you would recommend people sit down and do after they've listened to this podcast?
I think if you can go online and just Google thinking errors,
okay,
and become really familiar, there's a load of different free worksheets available. We tend to do about 10 different thinking errors, and we all do them.
Okay, yeah.
It's the very first step of starting to track your thoughts. A big part of CBT is learning to get in touch with that little voice, that little chip that's jumping up and down in your head all the time.
So something could be that you're catastrophizing.
Exactly.
So in Owning It, I have a small chapter on this, and I call them common mind traps.
Yes. Are thinking errors. So catastrophization or catastrophizing is one of them. Shoulding and musting, that's another one. We're great at doing that, I think, here in Ireland, telling ourselves we should be or we shouldn't be or we must do or we mustn't. Things like minimization or magnification, making something bigger or smaller, bigger than it really is. What else is there? Personalization. Yeah. So taking something as a personal thing.
Yeah, so if someone's in a bad mood around me, I will think that it's
You've
to do with me, and
it.
It's not all about you, Caroline. I have to keep telling myself. So yeah, so I think from what you're saying, it very much aligns with my approach that the first most important thing with anxiety is to accept where you are right now.
Mm.
And then before you even get onto the business of addressing it, so I call it the assess and address technique, and we're very much in the assess part of it, where we're looking at what anxiety is, how it functions, why it's so normal. Mm. And you might not think of it as a tool, but just understanding those processes, understanding the way we're primed to go negative, understanding that maybe you're in your threat, is a threat circle, or understanding, you know, that maybe you're personalizing or catastrophizing, just being able to label those things and sort of step away from yourself is probably a really good starting point with anxiety before you start throwing the kitchen sink at it in terms of different treatments.
Yes, absolutely. And it's if you go to therapy, that stage is called psychoeducation. So it's learning about your psychological experience. And again, it's one of the brilliant things about the internet. There's some great websites out there. So there's the Centre for Clinical Interventions, or CCI. I think it's .au. It's an Australian website.
I like mindtools.org.
Mindtools is great. And Psychology Tools is another one. They're all brilliant. They're free, evidence-based, I suppose, good resources. One of the things we were talking about earlier is about being careful where the information is coming from. And it is important to know that the information and those psychoeducation tools are accurate, I suppose, and are helpful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's definitely the first stage.
And before I let you go, what would you say to someone who is really afraid of the fear, who they're afraid of the anxiety itself? What would you say to reassure them? Because that's what I needed to hear.
Yeah, there's a part of me, there's the one bit that wants to reassure, and then there's the other bit that goes, I know that the only way to change is to go through pain.
Yeah.
So I suppose it's about there's something about this experience of pain, whenever we're experiencing it, that's trying to teach us something. So allowing yourself to learn through this experience. And I know for somebody going through a panic attack,
you don't want to hear
anxiety,
it.
That's not what you want to hear. And it's too hard.
But it's the reality, and it being willing to face down the barrel of it is the only way. I always say the only way around fear is through it.
It's through it, yeah. But I also think that it's important to remember that this too shall pass. It might feel like they're anxious 24/7, but in reality there might be 30 seconds, even every hour, where they're not anxious.
And they're not thinking about that.
And they're not thinking about that, exactly. These feelings are temporary states. They sometimes feel like they're permanent when we're feeling badly, but they fluctuate and they come and they go. And it's really important to remember that it will end. At some point, it will end.
It will end, and you will own it.
You will own it.
That was Dr. Claire Cambometu. I hope you enjoyed the second episode of my very own podcast. I hope that it's resonating with you. If you're enjoying it, please share, please let me know, send me a message on Instagram or Twitter, and if there's anything specific that you have in your head that you'd like to ask, or a topic that you really think should be covered, please do let me know, because this is my show, so I have the freedom to do whatever the hell I want. And thank you so much for joining me in, as I called it last week, and I'm going to do it again, the Owning It Revolution.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
The easiest way to access Owning It Real Time is to head to the link in the episode description or episode details, whatever you call them, show notes. You will find the link in there at the top. You can sign up right away for Owning It Real Time and access the full library of 10 situation-specific audio guides that will help you own your anxiety even more than you've ever done before.